I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, it ended last Thursday in Madison, a federal trial on Wisconsin's voter ID law, which takes into account not only the voter ID, but it also looks at other voting, some would say, restrictions in the state of Wisconsin. There were arguments from a number of people in front of U.S. District Judge James Peterson, and the decision should come sometime maybe at the end of July or maybe earlier than that. The judge said something interesting here. I'm sure whatever I do will make one side or the other unhappy. There's a good chance both sides will be unhappy, which I guess would be justice. We're going to be talking about the trial, and it's, as our first guest will say, likely to be appealed to a higher court. The suit was brought by One Wisconsin Now and Citizen Action of Wisconsin Education Fund. We're going to have three guests with us during the course of the hour. Laura White is joining us at the top of the hour. She was there. She's our state capitol reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio, and she was at the trial. She served before being with us as a reporter covering city and county government for the Cap Times. Todd Albaugh will be joining us then. He's got an interesting position here. He was chief of staff for Republican State Senator Dale Schultz, and he was privy to some backroom conversations about this law. He was in the closed Senate Republican caucus when the final round of multiple voter ID laws were being discussed, and he says that a handful of the GOP senators were giddy about the ramifications. We'll talk with him. He wound up getting so upset about all of this that it said it boiled his blood, left a pit in his stomach, and said, that's it, and he left the party, and he is now running a coffee shop in Madison, and later research director on One Wisconsin Now, one of the organizations that brought suit. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. On this topic, our phone lines get quite crowded, so I would recommend that you call in as early as possible. Laura White is our first guest, as I said, state capitol reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Laurel. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're a little bit faint. Are you? There we go. Just a little closer. Hello. Let me just hear you say, Laura White. Hi.
Hi.
There we go. It's a little better. There we go. That's much better. You sounded too far away, and I wanted to hear every word you had to say. Well, this was a pretty long trial, wasn't it? 9 days is a long time.
It was. It was 9 days, and we started every morning at 8 a.m. and wrapped up at about 6 p.m.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So that means that the judge heard from a whole lot of people. Who did he hear from?
He did. So he heard from, obviously, witnesses on both sides, the plaintiffs, as you mentioned, One Wisconsin Institute and Citizen Action of Wisconsin, were actually joined by some voters who said they were negatively impacted by the collection of voting laws that were at question in the case. So we heard from those folks sharing their personal experiences with the new laws. We also heard from a slate of expert witnesses on both sides, professors who have studied election law, legislation, voter fraud, things like that. And then we actually heard from county clerks on both sides of the case as well, for the plaintiff saying that the laws have been difficult to implement, and for the defense saying that it's helped them do their jobs.
Mm-hmm. So it went beyond, as far as I understand it, but I don't know the extent of this, it went beyond the voter ID and getting those voter IDs. It also went to early voting and to how many places are open and whether or not some places in the state make it easier to vote than others, and that's not fair. What was the extent of what the judge was looking at?
Sure. So the number of laws at question in this case was pretty expansive. They were calling into question more than a dozen voting-related laws, actually. Yeah. So quite a few. They have all been passed since 2011. So that was sort of what brings them all together. That's their common thread. They've all been passed in recent years. But as you mentioned, they ran the gamut from, you know, the new voter ID requirement, which people are aware of, to limiting the number of in-person absentee polling locations to just one location,
mm-hmm.
and shortening early voting times and hours in certain locations, which, as you mentioned, the defense argued and some clerks for the defense argued, it levels the playing field across the state because some areas don't have more opportunities to vote than others, more time.
So the judge needs to rule on all aspects here, or will make a general ruling that you need to redo this law? What are the options?
There are a lot of options, and I have to admit I'm not a legal expert, but I believe that he can choose elements of the case and rule on them rather than having to rule as a whole. And there are, as we mentioned, quite a few different elements at play here.
You, in a story that you wrote for us about this, quoted the judge, and I'm wondering if this is an unusual thing for somebody to say. I'm sure whatever I do, I'll make one side or the other unhappy. A good chance both sides will be unhappy, which I guess would be justice.
That was a more humorous moment in the trial. That was on the last day as he was sharing his plans for making his decision and when he expected the different parties to submit their final briefs to him and things like that. I think, you know, it's day nine and everybody was maybe a little bit feeling a little bit wacky and ready to get out of the windowless federal courtroom. But what he said preceding that quote was, I'll be making my decision. Obviously, one of the sides is going to be unhappy. And then there was sort of a chuckle in the courtroom. And then that's when he led into, actually, there's a good chance that both sides will be unhappy. So I think folks can read as much or as little into that as they would like.
And was the state's case in... Was the state's case, and we should remind people that we did ask people from the state to join us, and they declined, which is too bad because we'd like to hear from them. But was their case mostly that they were worried about and maybe had evidence of fraud in the state of Wisconsin?
There were three parts to the state's case that I think I can identify pretty clearly. One is what you mentioned, the possibility of voter fraud in the state of Wisconsin. That's primarily to do with the voter ID law, and that was the rationale folks had for passing that law. And the state argued that people, voters, are generally very supportive of voter ID laws because there is a perception that they make elections more secure, safer, more honest. Another element of the state's defense was the incredibly high turnout in the April presidential primary. They said if these laws are restrictive, we sure didn't see that in the high turnout in April. And then another pretty extensive part of their defense was calling witnesses who work for the state to go to the stand and outline the different procedures that they have for helping people navigate these new laws, whether that's getting the appropriate vital records to acquire a photo ID or helping people with registrations. That was a big part of their case, too, that there's an apparatus in place to support people.
And the judge expects to deliver a decision when?
Late July, what he said on the last day of the trial. He's aiming for late July. And he mentioned at that time that because that decision will come so close to the August 9th partisan primaries in Wisconsin, it's unlikely that his decision issued around then will have an effect on the August 9th partisan primary. So everything as it stands is expected to be in place in Wisconsin for the next election.
And then there's an appeal probably, no matter what happens here.
Absolutely. Yep, that's generally accepted that there will be an appeal no matter what happens.
And in terms of those who are upset about changes in early voting, et cetera, and voter ID, who testified in front of the judge in the courtroom?
Those that were concerned with the law?
Yes.
Sure. So there were, as I mentioned before, some folks who have had personal experiences with the law, particularly difficulty getting the photo ID that's now required to vote. So. A woman took the stand and spoke about an experience that she's had with her father, who's elderly, was born in the South, and they've had a hard time locating his birth certificate. And when they were able to get their hands on it, his birth certificate has a different name than the name he's gone by his entire life. So theirs is actually a 5-year process.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Yes. And the extent... the problems for folks with getting these vital records has stemmed from the South primarily. That was a major theme of the trial. People who were born in a certain time range in southern states with the help of midwives or places that didn't have extensive records have had a really hard time locating the things that they need to provide proof of identity to get a voting ID.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, it would have been a fascinating 9 days. I'm sure it was very long, but it must have been very, very interesting because this is certainly an issue that I would imagine the Supreme Court is going to be dealing with this in the not-too-distant future.
Absolutely, and it seems to be an issue that is at the forefront of a national conversation right now as well. So it was really interesting to see the debate in Wisconsin as this is playing out on the national stage as well. We were in court when the Virginia voter ID case was dismissed. And one of the questions I had for one of the witnesses at the time was, you know, what sort of effect does that have on this trial? Do people look and see
yes.
a law being upheld in another state? And does that have any sort of bearing on the case here? And she said the voter ID laws are so different state to state that it's really hard to say, you know, if something happens somewhere, if that's going to be sort of a harbinger of what's going to happen in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our own experience here, and now we're just waiting to see how it plays out.
Thank you, Laurel, so much for giving us the update. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Laurel White, State Capitol reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. She covered from 8 a.m. until after 6 p.m. for 9 days in the federal courthouse that, as she said, had no windows. So it was a long, long trial. So she was there for every single day of that, expecting a decision on this sometime in late July. Our next guest actually caught our attention when a Facebook comment that he wrote really went viral, and all of a sudden he was all over the press because of his experience in a closed Senate Republican caucus when the final round of multiple voter ID bills were being discussed. He said, Todd Alba, our guest, who was working for State Senator Dave Schultz, and he is now not in the state Senate anymore. Actually, Dale Schultz. Did I say Dave? Dave Schultz Water Park. That's where I went over the weekend. I'm sorry. Dale Schultz is the person I mean, Republican State Senator Dale Schultz, retired last year. And Todd had been a staffer for him for a long time and really a member of the Republican Party for a long time in his adult life. So he sent this Facebook post in which he talked about a handful of the GOP senators giddy about the ramifications of voter ID, and he says literally singling out the prospects of suppressing minority and college voters. Todd has agreed to join us to talk more about what went on in the Senate Republican caucus and his testimony before the court last week because he was called to testify. And we are going to be taking your phone calls now, too. I know some of you have been waiting. Just stay with us a moment longer, please, and we'll be with you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Todd, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be on.
Nice to have you here. I've seen you all over the place since your Facebook page went totally, totally viral. And you're now at a coffee shop, huh, on University Avenue in Madison?
Well, thanks for the plug.
Yeah.
You know, it's not quite like Trump steaks and wine, but we have a small little independent coffee shop here in Madison called Fifth Element Coffee, and my old college buddy from UW-Platteville and UW-Richland, who was a foreign exchange student from El Salvador, and we've maintained a friendship for over 30 years.
Oh.
So it's a direct relationship coffee where we buy directly from the farmers in El Salvador, and so it's exciting and a different life post-politics.
It sure is a different life post-politics. For those people who didn't see your Facebook post, let's have you fill in the rest of this sentence. You want to know you write why I left the Republican Party as it exists today. Here it is. This was the last straw. What was the last straw, Todd?
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to explain kind of the backstory, because I think it's important as to why I ended up as a witness in federal court. I was just irritated because I happened to be in the room back in 2011 in the Republican Senate caucus. For those listeners who might not be aware, both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are allowed. It's kind of the exemption that's carved out in the state's open records or open meetings law. It allows Republicans and Democrats from both the Assembly and Senate to go into a private meeting where only they and their staff are allowed to discuss basically whatever governmental issue they would like to. And so I was in one of those meetings, and when this bill was kind of getting towards going to the floor, and one of the state senators stood up, and the meeting wasn't going quite the way she wanted to. There wasn't initially a lot of excitement, and she said, you know, I kind of pounded her finger on the table and said, hey, we need to start thinking about what this means for the neighborhoods around Milwaukee and the college campuses across the state. And then my former boss, Dale Schultz, kind of raised his hand and said, you know, I think we ought to stop here for a second and realize not just what we're talking about for our party, but also for citizens across Wisconsin. And at that point, another senator who basically outed himself on Milwaukee public or Milwaukee television, rather, Senator Grothman, who's now in Congress, said, well, you know, what I'm really concerned about here is winning. And, you know, I think we better what I'm concerned about is winning, and that we all know the Democrats would do this, use these kind of powers if they were in control. So we better get to it while we still have the opportunity. Because, of course, at that time, that's about when the recall, the round of recall, not just for the governor, but also for various state senators, was beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, my boss turned around and said, you stay here. I'm going down to my office. And he left, and I stayed there and took notes and stayed in the room. But it struck me, because as someone who had spent my entire life since I was 12 years old volunteering on Republican campaigns, I never thought that I would be in a room where the party that I had worked for, a party who once stood for an expansion of voter rights, to go back to give a history lesson quickly, you know, back to Bob La Follette and Bell Case La Follette. Bob La Follette, of course, was a Republican governor of Wisconsin who fought for expanded voting rights. Bell Case La Follette, his wife, was instrumental in the women's suffrage movement in this country. And, you know, here I was, the same party, all these years later, talking about singling out people and taking, or at least suppressing, someone's constitutional rights. And it just struck me as completely not what I stood for, completely not something that I could advance the cause for. And it was really at that point that I decided internally that I just couldn't continue with the party. So fast forward to this past the day before the April elections here in Wisconsin, and one of my employees, Mikey, was born in California, moved out here, and we hired him. He's a great barista behind the bar. He happens to be a Mexican-American, Latino, 22 years old, and went to register to vote the day before the voting, and found out that he couldn't just use his valid California driver's license and trade it in for a Wisconsin one. Now you have to have one of three things: either a valid United States passport, your original birth certificate, or if you were not born in this country, your original naturalization papers. Well, you know, what 22-year-old knows where his or her original birth certificate is, mm-hmm. let alone being in California? So he wasn't able to get it. He wasn't able to vote. I was ticked off about it, and you would have thought, after all my time working in communications and state government, I would realize that social media is social and worldwide. But I just kind of vented to some friends that, you know, this is why I left the Republican Party.
Right.
I was there at the front end and there at the back end, and from there it kind of snowballed, and I've agreed to talk about it simply because I think it's an issue that the public needs to be aware of.
Yeah. The state response, when we look at the primary, and they use this in the trial that you just participated in, is that, you know, look at the turnout, voter suppression. How can you even begin to say that, because we had this huge presidential primary turnout?
Well, that's a very creative response, and I give them credit. It's not something that's unexpected, nor is it a surprise. It's the policy that Governor Walker's team has followed. Be an illusionist. Create an illusion on one side and do the opposite while people aren't looking. This trial is not about voter turnout. It's about whether there was intent to deliberately suppress the vote. If you want to talk about turnout for a moment, we can do that. According to the Pew Research Group, there was, if you look at the first 12 states across the United States, the Republican primaries, the presidential election, all 12 of the first states, that's the numbers that were in so far when I looked, had record turnouts. Why is that? Probably because there's someone named Bernie Sanders running as a Democrat and Donald Trump, who is running as a Republican. Mm-hmm. Those people were exciting to vote and increase the voter turnout. So, it's not, but that's not the point. That's not what this trial was about. This trial was about whether or not there was intent to deliberately use these law bills, which became laws, to suppress a certain segment of the voting public in order for political gain.
Mm-hmm. So what happened when you were in the courtroom, Todd? Did the judge question you at all? Did you? How long were you on the stand? What response did you get?
It was a very interesting experience.
I'll bet.
I never been in a federal court as a witness. I've been there a couple of times just to observe. I spent a very brief time working for an attorney friend of mine. I'm not an attorney, but I was there helping in a trial that he was in. But to be on a witness stand is interesting. I will say this. I was very impressed with Judge Peterson. He's a new federal judge. He took Judge Shabazz's place on the bench, in the federal bench. And I thought he was very thoughtful and deliberate. And during the opening for both the prosecution and the defense, he interrupted both of them and asked them questions. Asked the attorneys, hey, you know, basically, if you were in my place, how would you look at this? And I thought he did a really good job of that. I was on the stand for, I didn't keep track, I would say initially, the one in Wisconsin now, attorney of plaintiffs, they asked me things for probably, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. The defense, the attorney general's office, cross-examined me for another 5 or 6 minutes, and then the redirect, they call it, where the plaintiff gets back up, I think maybe another 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the judge asked me just I think one time when I did I was asked to name specific senators who said things, and I did do that on the stand, because I think when you go before a federal judge and under oath, I think you're obligated to tell the truth, and so I did so. I had not done so previously, just because, with all due respect, I have a great admiration for the press. I used to work at radio myself, but I think there was a lower bar when a reporter asks you to name names. I didn't have a wire on me, obviously. I didn't have a recording device.
Right.
So beyond my word, and my boss has said that, he has said that, my honesty is beyond reproach, I think is what he said when the press asked him about my comments. But beyond that, I don't have, specific proof. So I didn't name names initially, but when I was asked to do so on the stand, I certainly did.
Were there members of that Senate Republican caucus who were as uncomfortable as you were by what was being said?
I don't recall speaking to another Senate Republican staffer directly about it. Some of them I've known for several years. Some were very new at the time. By body language and just kind of by looking at each other in the eye, I certainly think there were some who were uncomfortable by it. As I said on the stand as well, there were some senators who were uncomfortable by it. Senator Cole, Senator Olson, Senator Kedzie, were very dour, and I think I used the term ashen-faced because I think they knew, much like my boss, my former boss, that this is a very disturbing place to go. And then there were others who, yes, were giddy. And that's what bothered me, quite frankly, about it, was it wasn't just talking about, suppressing people's, specifically minorities in the Milwaukee area and college students who traditionally vote Democrat. They were actually, some of them, a handful of them, giddy, happy, whatever term you want to use. It was that they were excited by this and could, and that's the disturbing part, that's really, and both sides, and I'm one person, I have one opinion, there are certainly others, but, I've worked in and out of politics for over 30 years at both the state and federal level, and, in the last 4 years or so, it has become, beyond just winning, it has become destroying the other side and their ideas, so they no longer exist. And you throw in the dark money now that is possible with the the Citizens United verdict, and you know, the local, or here in Wisconsin, the court verdict that basically wiped out the prohibition on coordinating between those dark money groups and campaigns. And then you throw in redistricting, and you know, it's a very tough row to hoe to try to find an elected official at the state level who is not going to succumb to a variety of those things. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that the dynamics that they're thrown into now, it makes it very difficult to really stand up for what you believe if you want to keep your job. That's truly, in my personal opinion, that's the choice you have to make now if you're an elected official of the state of Wisconsin. Am I willing to stand up for what I believe, even if it means losing my position?
Yeah. Well, something has to change so that can be the case, because those are just the kind of people you want to have in office, and those are the kind of people like you want to have as campaign staffers. So what do we do about that, Todd?
Well, I appreciate there are a lot better staffers than I am, that's for sure. You know, I've told people, you know, people thank me, as I was, you know, use the term courageous. I say my sister who fights type 1 diabetes every day, my grandmother who was the first woman to be a dean of a University of Wisconsin institution in the state of Wisconsin, my mom who is a single mom raising my sister and I, those people are courageous to me. I simply did what I was taught as a kid, and that's to do the right thing. And so I think what it really is going to take is citizens going to the ballot box. And that's why this decision is so important, not just the voter ID, but as your Capitol reporter said before I came on, this is a variety, a compilation of all these different, I call them, voter suppression bills. You know, what the courts decide, and whether or not, you know, whatever Judge Peterson's decision is, will most likely be appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court, which includes Indiana, which is another state that has very restrictive voter ID laws. And most likely that will not affect the April 9th primary in the state of Wisconsin, and it could or could not affect the November general election. But these court decisions are very important, because we need people to get to the ballot box, regardless of whichever side you're on this issue. I truly believe that people's ability to have a fair and free election and access to the ballot box, mm-hmm. that is what it takes. I mean, you know, not to come down one side or the other, but, you know, people who want to say that, you know, how can Governor Walker get a second term? Well, if you look at the voting results, if you look particularly in southeast Wisconsin, the Milwaukee area, fewer Democrats turned out in the last general election for governor than turned out in the last presidential election for President Obama. If all of those people who came out and voted for President Obama in the second term had voted in the last general election, Governor Walker would not have been reelected. So it comes down to whether or not you're motivated to get out and vote. And that's not to lay the blame on anyone specifically, but people cannot underestimate the power of the vote. People say my vote doesn't matter. It does. Voting does matter. So we have to encourage our fellow citizens to go out and vote, and we have to ensure that that process is fair and open.
Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the trial that just ended last Thursday. It was a 9-day trial in Madison that was looking at voter ID and various other pieces of legislation that had been passed by Governor Walker and the legislature dealing with voting in the state of Wisconsin. Those who brought suit found that it was restrictive, that it was making it harder to vote, with a disproportionate burden on minorities and on young people in this state. Our guest this hour has an interesting situation here, because he was a staffer for State Republican Senator Dale Schultz, and he was in a closed Senate Republican caucus as a staffer for him when the final round of multiple voter ID bills were being discussed. He sent a Facebook comment. It was picked up about how giddy some of these people were and how they subsequently wanted to win. They had, he said, to take the coward's way out and come up with a plan to suppress the vote under the guise of voter fraud. We have a lot of people who want to call in about voter fraud, so we're going to be talking about that. As a result of this Facebook page, Todd was all over television and radio and now testified at the beginning of this 9-day trial about what he heard and the giddiness and the reasons for these voter bills that came from the senators themselves. He wound up leaving the party, and he is now co-owner of the Fifth Element Coffee on University Avenue in Madison. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Arnold in Minocqua is our first caller for you. Hi, Arnold.
I have two questions. First one is, prior to this bill, was there an assessment done to protect the sanctity of each election in the sense that it was impossible for any person to register, say, in their home district as a citizen and then again as a student in a different area? Was there some kind of check and balance system that didn't prevent that? And the second question is what state agencies or offices or whomever that you called, who rejected the opportunity to appear today?
I didn't produce the show, but they didn't respond to interview requests. Scotty will give us, if he's listening not right now, and I'm sure that he will, he'll give us a list of people that he contacted.
Well, I'd like to know who these were. I think it's important that people know who rejected the opportunity to speak or address
okay.
this question.
All right. Yeah, your point is valid. We'll ask Scotty to, he can just come in and say it too on the air if he'd like. Did you get that first part of the question, Todd?
Yeah, I did, and I'm not aware. My former boss, Dale Schultz, was not on the Senate Elections Committee at the time. That was chaired by Senator Mary Lozick at the time. So I don't recall going to those committee meetings. So I'm not aware of any assessments done formally by the Senate Committee on, you know, access or whether someone had how it was prevented of someone voting in one town and then voting in another. I can tell you that, in full disclosure, my former boss did vote for that first round of voter ID bills, or as I call it, voter suppression, because he was told by Senator Lozick and others that there is all this voter fraud. We have all this voter fraud. And they kept bringing up all these busloads of people from Chicago being taken up to Milwaukee area to vote illegally under voter fraud. Dale was someone who really respected the chairmanship process of Senate committees and expected his colleagues to be truthful with him just like he was with them. So he wasn't comfortable with it, but he voted for it. And when the second round came up, limiting the number of hours, voting for absentee and the like, that's when he asked us to do an internal assessment. So I, along with our staff, did as much of an assessment as we were able to, and we were only able to come up with two actual cases of voter fraud at the time in the state of Wisconsin. One was Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's estranged wife, who had gone back and voted once in her home state of Idaho and then had voted also in Wisconsin. And another was a Republican staffer who had voted in her hometown and then voted in the Madison area as well. That was it. And when pressed, even currently, Republicans can't come up with this laundry list of specific cases of voter fraud. Now Congressman Grossman actually reached out to me, and we had a 20-minute phone call after kind of some of this press came out, and he said to me again on the phone that hey, can we prove that there's fraud? Probably not. But what his specific quote was, he said, we think that Democrats cheat and we don't. I mean, that's why they did this, and that's, it just seems ludicrous to me.
Let's welcome. Thank you very much for your call, and we'll take more calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us this part of our show is Todd Albaugh, and he was a staffer for Senator Dale Schultz and was in, he wrote this Facebook page posting because he was in private meeting with senators who were discussing, it was the Senate Republican Caucus. It was a closed Senate Republican Caucus, and they were talking about the multiple voter ID bills, and he described what he saw and how giddy they were about the possibility of restrictions on voting. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Todd. David is next in Hudson. Hi, David.
Hi, Kathleen. How you doing?
Good. How are you? How are you, David?
Great.
Good.
I just want to say that I completely agree with basically everything your second guest has said. So maybe I got to stop down by his coffee shop in Madison next time I'm there. But I just want to say that I think the voter ID laws it doesn't make sense with the Republican platform because, one, there isn't actually a lot of voter ID fraud in the state in general, and two, it just necessitates more governmental action to enforce this law, which apparently, like on the Republican platform, they want less government. So it just seems a little contradictory to me.
Todd.
I appreciate the comment, David, and I couldn't agree with you more, actually. I grew up in a time in the 80s and early 90s when you're exactly right. Republicans would rail against Democrats because they wanted too much control in Madison, too much control in Washington. And you know, I've been involved since 1980. I have never seen a more aggressive play for centralized control in Madison than I have in the last 4 to 5 years. Anything from these sort of things and voting rights, you look at what happened in northern Wisconsin with the mine issue and usurping local control for environmental standards, frac sand mining in northern and western Wisconsin, the high-capacity wells in central Wisconsin with water rights. All of these things are being, you know, their power plays to usurp local control, which, of course, as David pointed out, is completely contradictory to the historical party platforms of Republicans, which is less control in Madison and Washington, more control locally.
Thank you, David, very much for your call. Jacob in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, I'd actually like to talk about the Republican ideals again as well. Why has this issue come up now? And in the past, they weren't supporting voter fraud at all. I mean, there was no issue. So now we come to present day, and we have this issue where you have fraudulent voting going on, but yet you hear of no problems where people are being brought into polls. I think that it's fundamentally our right to vote, and why do we want to oppress anybody's ability to vote and express their views in a democratic manner through oppression? I guess my... My question is why have you not been able to, you as a program, I feel NPR should have both sides. And I think that the first person who called in got to that point. Why do you not have the Republican side of this being represented?
Yeah, I explained that. The Director of Communications and Public Affairs at the Wisconsin Department of Justice was a place for us to go, and they did not respond to us. It was requested.
Okay. I guess that's my only other comment. I think going back to the prior hour, not to pull you back, but looking at changing the mission statement of...
Yeah, we're not talking about that this hour. We got enough on our plate. I'm sorry, Jacob. Let's go to David in Milwaukee.
Hey, Kathleen,
yes, Todd, go ahead.
I could put in a quick plug. I can tell you from spending 25, 30 years at the Capitol, especially on the Republican side, there is... Again, I don't want to put everybody in this net, but there is a great disdain for Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television because there is a thought process, a stereotype, that they are very liberal and they're going to crucify Republicans if you go on their programs. And they stay away intentionally. And if people would only listen, I think Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television does a better job of trying to provide both sides than any other commercial media because they don't interrupt. They let you get your points out, and they give you lots of time to do it. So I don't understand. This is something that my former boss used to love going on Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television because he could get his idea out.
Right.
The Ideas Network. So I just wanted to defend Public Radio.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We appreciate it. And what about David's point? Why is, or somebody else's point, why is all of this coming up now? Why have so many states passed voter ID right now? Did the idea come from somebody, some institute, or what was the genesis?
I mean, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories about, you know, Alec, and we probably don't have time to get into all of that. You know, there's these right-wing conspiracies
right.
that they're trying to do. I'm not so sure about all that, quite frankly. There was a Supreme Court, and I'm not election expert either, but there was a Supreme Court ruling some time ago. It was called Frank versus Walker, not like Governor Walker, but another Walker. Basically, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, ruled that they believe that voter fraud does exist. I mean, there are cases, however isolated. You can't say there aren't. So the Supreme Court ruled there are cases of voter fraud. It exists, and it is the state's, small s, government, in other words,
priority or responsibility, rather, to prevent that. So, and that's something that Judge Peterson, in this case in Wisconsin last week, actually singled out. He said, hey, my hands are kind of tied here to a certain degree because the Supremes have already ruled that it exists. But again, when Wisconsin now, Josh Call, the primary attorney, did an excellent job, I thought, in saying, Your Honor, we're not asking you to go against the Supreme Court. We see a narrow window here that is in conjunction with the Supreme Court case. We don't deny that voter fraud exists. What we're here is to challenge is the intent of this particular voter ID bill, along with the other ones that we're going to present to you today. So again, this isn't about whether or not voter fraud exists or whether or not the state should go after it. It's about the intent of these specific bills.
Right.
And Justice Kennedy at the U.S. Supreme Court has said not only in this, but also in redistricting, which is another whole court case going on, that's something that he's going to be looking for if and when it would ever reach the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah. Stay with us, Todd. We also want to introduce to the conversation Jenny Dye. Jenny is research director at One Wisconsin Now. It's a nonprofit issue advocacy organization, one of the groups that filed the lawsuit. She is an attorney and an elected official on the Dane County Board. Jenny, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us on and talking about this important issue.
We were talking with Laurel earlier in this hour. This was a very, very long trial. I was amazed. And you were there a lot of hours for a lot of days, weren't you? Did you feel as though you had a chance to really make your case?
Well, it was a long trial, but that's because there have been so many attacks on the right to vote in Wisconsin that in order to really fully air all of the challenges that voters have seen over the past years since these voting restrictions began to be passed, with voter ID just being one of those, it took time to get that information out and before the judge, and we want to make sure that all of these issues are fully heard and we get a decision that hopefully protects people's right to vote.
And are you looking for something that looks at voter ID? Are you looking at something that deals with early voting? I mean, there were so many different issues. How does a ruling come down?
Well, I think I would imagine that the judge will go through and make a decision on each of those individually, although part of the idea of this lawsuit was that this has been an orchestrated attack and that all of these changes, layered upon layer, really combined to make a situation in which legal voters find themselves unable to be able to cast a ballot. And the situation that Todd Alba was describing with his employee is just one of so many examples that we have heard both in the trial and then from individuals who have just been trying to vote in Wisconsin since these laws have been passed.
And talk about those people. Let's talk, because a lot of the concern here was that minority voters are, what is it, more than five times as likely as white voters to need a free ID. 20% of those applying for an ID were rejected. What did you hear from minority voters, low-income voters, about how difficult it may be for them to get a voter ID? Because everybody on the other side, they would say, well, it's a free voter ID. You can get one. It's a really easy thing.
Right. And I think that is the experience for so many of us who have a driver's license and use it to drive. And we have had it since we turned 16, probably. But there are many people in the state of Wisconsin who are eligible voters who do not have that same experience. And it was really striking to me the differences in who we heard from when One Wisconsin Institute was making our case and we were sharing these stories of people in urban areas, people who had moved around a lot, people like Laurel had mentioned about who grew up in the South, maybe grew up in a time period where records were not as available as they feel like they are now, who had challenges providing that documentation. And then when the state made their case, their witnesses were primarily from less diverse, more suburban communities where there's less population per one clerk's office. And so it's easier for those people to be able to get to their clerk's office. Their community is smaller. There are less people there. And it's people who live there that don't have the same challenges that we see as voters in urban areas have. And that, to me, is really, in some ways, I feel like the state, by presenting those witnesses, helped us to make our case.
Mm-hmm. And what about the issue of early voting, of weekend voting? I know the Waukesha County Clerk testified that urban districts in Madison and Milwaukee gave too much access to the voters as far as opportunities by offering weekend voting hours. How does it stand right now in the state? I guess many of us aren't familiar with who sets the rules as to what kinds of hours there will be and locations there will be for voting places, and should there be something that's standardized? You can't vote on the weekend in Milwaukee if you can't vote in Waukesha. What was that all about?
Sure. There was a law that was passed before the last election cycle that restricted early voting to no longer allow early voting to be on weekends and to restrict the number of hours that clerks can provide during the week. And before that, it was really up to the individual clerks and communities like the city of Madison, or, you know, I live in Fitchburg, and Fitchburg offered extended voting hours. The city of Milwaukee also did, to provide hours on the weekends or after work so that people who maybe were trying not to have to take time out from their job could stop by and vote at a time that was convenient to them during the weeks and weekends leading up to the elections. Many of those times are no longer available, and essentially what has happened is under the state law, early voting is restricted to business hours. That has now become a standard for everyone. And when you say that it's the same standard for everyone, it sounds like it's fair. But the reality is that means that a voter who lives in a town of 500 people and a voter who lives in a town of 50,000 people have the exact same hours for 500 people and 50,000 people to try to vote. Mm-hmm. And we really should be focused on what is the equality for the voter, not what is an equality for a municipality.
Mm. Let's go to phone calls for both of you. We have a ton of people on hold, and the time, she's getting short. Art in Ripon. Hi, Art.
Hi, Kathleen. I have a couple of points that I'd like to quickly make. It seems the terminology as far as voter fraud, you know, voter ID only stops voter impersonation, which is a very, very slim amount of fraud. Even in the case before Judge Edelman, there were basically they couldn't come up with any instances of it happening. And also, with the original law that was put into place in Indiana and went before the Supreme Court, they actually had an affidavit that those people could sign if they could not produce a voter ID that said that they were who they were and they were able to vote. Not like a lot of these laws that have happened since Indiana, where it seems like they just want to pile on heavier and heavier burdens on people to vote. And the other thing I have to say, too, is for Justice Stevens and Judge Posner, both of them have come out talking about whether or not this really was a wise decision to have voter ID to begin with, and also that especially Judge Posner has talked about how he feels that it has been warped into something that has been voter suppression.
Jenny.
I think those are great points. And in fact, one of the arguments that our organization has been making for years is that when you look at that Indiana law that did go to the Supreme Court and that Judge Posner has since said he feels like maybe he got wrong, the Wisconsin law is so much more restrictive. And not only is the law more restrictive, but in Indiana, they have DMV access on evenings and weekends and more locations than we have here in Wisconsin. And so the practicality for somebody to be able to go and get an ID is totally different from state to state and community to community. And these laws interact with all of those other sort of practical circumstances of how we live our lives to impact specific people and specific populations in very intentional ways.
Let's go next to Peter in Mequon. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kathleen. I was calling because, well, actually, you asked earlier what was the genesis of this, why did these laws come about?
Uh-huh.
I think you can go back to, the demographics, which show that we are increasingly becoming, and will be by 2050, a majority-minority country. The Republicans realize that if and when that happens, they basically are a minority party. So they had to take steps, and they began this back in 2004 or even before that. Karl Rove put pressure on federal prosecutors to find voter fraud cases. You remember the case of a prosecutor in New Mexico wrote a book about his experience and the pressure he faced to find and prosecute voter fraud cases. He couldn't do it. The other point that I guess I would like to make is this is not the end game. The Republicans, if they continue to lose elections, especially at the national level, will try to do other things. After the 2012 election, they made a proposal, which was quickly abandoned, but they were going to go to proportional designation of the Electoral College votes, but they only wanted to do it in the seven states that were swing states that they lost, including Wisconsin. They, like I said, they quickly abandoned that after it was obviously so transparent what they were trying to do.
Thank you, Peter. We are plumb out of time, and we thank you very much for your call. I want to be sure and thank Todd. Thank you very much for being with us, Todd.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and all the best with your new business and with reentering politics when everything is positive again. Thank you very much. Jenny, thank you so much for being with us. Do you have a place on your, do you have a website where it gives more information about all that happened at the trial, Jenny? Just quickly.
We have our press releases about what's been going on at the trial, and we'll continue to put them out as updates come along, as
Great.
Judge Peterson makes decisions. It's onewisconsininstitute.com.
Thank you. Thanks, Jenny, so much. Our thanks to Todd Alba, previously served as chief of staff for Republican State Senator Dale Schultz, and thanks to Jenny Dye, research director at One Wisconsin Now, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, and we thank also Laura White, state capitol reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. Once again, we did contact the communications office for the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and they declined to respond so that we could hear that point of view. But, you know, we'll keep trying. We can always keep trying. Thanks for listening. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers.
Celebrate Wisconsin cycling. Wisconsin Bike Fed sponsors Wisconsin Bike Week, scheduled for the week of June 4th. There will be dozens of events statewide and activities for people of all ages and abilities, including family fun rides to commuter stations. WPR is proud to promote outdoor community activities. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.